Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the little world where children have their existence, says Pip in Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, there is nothing so finely perceived and finely felt as injustice. So begins Nobel laureate Amartya Sen's great new exploration of social justice. Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Kant, John Rawls have all tried to get us there. After a lifetime of investigation, this economist and philosopher has other ideas for a globalized world. This hour, On Point, Nobel laureate Amartya Sen on social justice. You can join the conversation. Do we need a new way of thinking about getting closer to justice, real social justice on this planet? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Nobel Prize-winning economist and philosopher Amartya Sen, professor at Harvard University, former master at Trinity College in Cambridge, England, son of Bengal, longtime champion of the disadvantaged. His new book is a kind of great summation, The Idea of Justice. London's The Independent calls it a monumental work. Amartya Sen, it's wonderful to have you back with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's a long time since your boyhood in East Bengal, now Bangladesh.
Yes.
You put a lot of work in
over both sides of Bengal, Bangladesh as well as West Bengal.
And West Bengal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, there's so much to get into here, but just 75 years you've trod this planet. Now you've thought about justice for many of those decades. Is it possible to put a scale on this? Are we doing any better or worse today than we were, let's say, when you were a boy?
Oh, I think we are doing better. I think there are two things to say. One is that we are certainly doing better, but the other is that we could have done a lot better than we are doing now. I think I grew up in famines of 1943 with 3 million people died around
in
me.
In India. Mm-hmm.
In India, yeah, in Bengal, in fact. Mm-hmm. On both sides, what is now Bangladesh and what's now West Bengal in India. I think that kind of thing doesn't happen. On the other hand, continuing undernourishment, even in India, remains very strong. The huge gaps in the... we're debating here about lack of health care for 46
yes.
million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the latest
seven
number. Going on to seven. Yeah, 47. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that indicates... that we are failing to remove injustice in a way that we could have been able to do if we put our act together. And of course, people are trying. It's a question of not denying that there have been progress. I think it would be stupid to take the view, which often people say, rich are getting richer, poor getting poorer, life is getting worse. None of these are true. In fact, the poor are not getting poorer. On the other hand, there's a hell of a lot of poor people around, and we haven't been able to deal with that issue sufficiently. So I think it's a question of keeping balance and yet keeping your attention on how things could be done to change things.
But in this book, The Idea of Justice, a kind of masterwork, you are asking us to reorient a little bit, to look at the compass settings that have come to us from a lot of big philosophers and maybe reset our compass a bit. I wish you'd give us a bit of a kind of directional... philosopher's short course on here. You look at this line of descent from the Enlightenment of Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and Kant, and most particularly John Rawls, who has been your teacher, colleague.
Absolutely, great influence.
A great influence. You dedicate the book to him, and yet you say there's something in that line of descent of our thinking about justice that's off by your lights, and you'd like us to recalibrate. What is it?
Well, I think that to the extent that the book is a philosophy book and is primarily that, I'm really arguing that that one of the great things that happened in the Enlightenment period, namely celebration of reasoning and public reasoning, led ourselves in two rather different directions. One was a direction of looking for what an ideally just world would look like. And people who looked for a kind of ideal social contract, going back to Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and Kant to a great extent, though he went beyond that too, concentrated on that. But there was another type of reasoning, of which a great champion was Adam Smith, who was often remembered mainly as an economist, but of course he was professor of moral philosophy.
And your hero, or one of them.
He's a great hero. In fact, I've been very involved in writing a new long introduction to the 250th anniversary edition of his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiment. Mm-hmm. And there the concentration is always how to remove injustice in the world. And that's not, you know, we may not agree on what a perfectly just society would look like, but you could still agree that these steps will certainly reduce injustice in the world. And I think Smith did that to a great extent. The mathematician Condorcet in France, who is the founder of one of the subjects I worked on, the mathematical theory of social choice, he was involved. Mary Wollstonecraft, I'd put in that direction. Later on, John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, all of them have in many different ways contributed to our thinking about how to reduce injustice in the world.
It can sound like a subtle distinction, but you bring it to us as quite an important one. You've got, let's say, John Rawls saying that social justice depends on having just institutions.
Yes.
On the other hand, you're saying, oh, well, let's not get hung up on that. Let's go straight at reducing injustice. It can sound like a subtle difference, but it's not.
Tom, you are right. I think it is. It may sound like a, and in some ways it is, a subtle difference. I think there are two issues there. One is that Rawls, who is actually the greatest moral philosopher of our time and a huge influence on me, concentrated on this classic view as to what would an ideally just world look like. And that's a kind of social contract approach, which we have got since Hobbes's time.
And he said that was important. He said, imagine that you have no idea where you're going to be born into the world. Try and construct a world.
Which would be perfect, yes. But you see, the real difficulty is that quite often, A, that's very remote. B, we may not actually agree. I mean, I'm a great believer in Rawls, and Rawls, one of the reasons why he's such an influence on me, is that he always encouraged me to pursue my doubt. I got from him affection, but also encouragement to pursue my doubt. And in those discussions, of course, we end up in situations where we may disagree. We tend to disagree on the relative importance of liberty on one side and inequality of incomes, for example, on the other side. And we don't have to agree in order to agree in the time of, say, Smith and Wollstonecraft, the removal of slavery being a good improvement, the removal of subjugation of women being very important. We don't have to agree on a perfectly just world for that. I mean, let me give an example, Tommy. Can I just give a very crude example? Suppose you've got yourself stuck for some reason in a sauna.
Stuck in a sauna. I'm sweating already.
You're sweating already, and somehow you find that you can't open the door. Mm-hmm. And it's getting just too hot, intolerably so. Mm-hmm. There's a guy outside, you ask him to help, and he says he can't open the door either, he tries, but he can control the temperature. And you say, yes, for God's sake, would you please cut the temperature down, dramatically down? And he said, I will do it, but this is not the scientific way of proceeding. First, tell me what is the perfect temperature that you want. And I said, look, I don't know what the perfect temperature is, but for God's sake, get on going and try to reduce the temperature down quite a bit. I know for one thing that it's hell of a lot less than what it is right now. Now, I think to ask the question, what would be the perfect situation there, is completely the wrong way of going. And the same is true today. If 47 million people in America don't get health care, if there are a whole lot of people dying every day, every minute, of AIDS and other illnesses which could be controlled. More people died on 9/11, to remember that day 6 years ago. More people died on that day of AIDS than they died of violence, including everyone who died in the 9/11 tragedy. Terrific tragedy, fantastically nasty tragedy. But even that day, there were more people dying of that. And there are all kinds of ways in which we can change the world, and we could agree on many things. And at the same time, we may not agree on what a perfectly just world would look like.
But for centuries, our effort has been put in many ways, to building the institutions, even nations, national structures, the United States itself, to try and get closer to an ideal system that would support justice. Are you saying we've got the institutions good enough. Never mind about that. Just send flood relief. Just send tsunami relief.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm very much a believer in institutional change. And indeed, if you're dealing with, say, health care, I think I'm very much a supporter of the view what we need primarily is an institutional change in the United States. And similarly, we need a change of patent laws to come back to issues like the AIDS question, that drugs that can be produced cheaply cannot be produced because of the counterproductive nature of the patent laws and so on. So we do need institutional change. But it's one thing to ask the question what institutional change we could agree on which would certainly reduce injustice in the world in a way that's patently clear to everyone, as opposed to asking what would be a perfectly just system. Now, you know, we don't... Is 41% top tax rate more just than 40% top tax rate? I may not know the answer, but I may still know that a 0% tax rate would be very bad, or we could take a view on in which direction to move. So I think it's not so much that I'm decrying institutions, but I think it's the combination of looking for perfect justice in institutional terms is to ask the question, primarily in this form, what are the perfectly just institutions? And it also neglects the fact that so much of the atrocities in the world are not because of only institutions, but also our behavior. I think you began by quoting from whom I quote, Charles Dickens's Pip saying how he was maltreated by his sister when he was young. Well, this is not a criticism that Pip is making of the family system. He's making a criticism about the way his sister behaved towards her.
To him. One sister, one brother, and some injustice right there.
And so it's really much more than institutions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning thinker Amartya Sen about social justice and how we can make more of it. His big new book, the culmination of a much heralded life's work, is The Idea of Justice. Amartya Sen, the economist calls you the economist who thinks like a philosopher these days. That's an important spot to be in. A lot of people want to join us right here. Let me go right to Spokane, Washington, if I may. And Charles, you're on the air with Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. A great pleasure to speak with you. I was just, as far as justice and stuff, I went back to when I was in college, and there was this debate that took place with Socrates, and he was talking about how justice has a form, and then there was a sophist who was named Thermisicus or something, and he says, no, what it is, it's just the people in power are the ones that are making the rules, and everybody else is just kind of chumps. Does that make sense?
Everyone else just sort of chomps what makes it up as they go along?
Yeah, they're the ones that saying this is what's just, and you know, and it's just a way of controlling people, and they put it under the name of justice.
So where do you stand on that? With Socrates, who said there's a form, we need to imagine it and assert it, or with the one who feels it's just a power play?
Well, I believe there is a form, but I also believe that that the way that the society structure right now, it seems to go the direction of the sophist in this argument, you know, that right now people kind of just set up things, you know, and then we're supposed to go along and then we assume that this is just.
Amartya Sen, and thanks very much, Charles.
Yeah, I think Charles is raising a very important question. That is, the rhetoric of justice is used in many different ways. On one side, it may lead to a huge protest. We think of civil rights movements here that was in the name of injustice, of removing injustice. It led to the French Revolution and many other things you can think of. It led to the fight for independence of India from the British rule, and so on. And at the same time, the word justice is also used in a way that is, as Charles puts it, it's just called as justice, and that's what it is. And there has been that tendency also. I mean, the famous Holy Roman Emperor described that let justice be done even if the world perishes. Mm. Now, this can't be in the interest of people in the world, but the idea that this is justice, and I define it, and that's what there's all there is to it, is a trend, but I think we can resist that. I mean, I think even that statement of Pipit, which you began, indicates mm-hmm. that the idea of injustice does communicate with people.
It's finely perceived. It's finally felt, starting right in childhood. We know it when we see it.
Exactly. And so we could say that, look, you may wish to call it justice, but I won't call it justice. And that's exactly what people did. That's what Gandhi did. That's what Martin Luther King did. That's what Mandela did in South Africa, and so forth. And I think, so Charles's point is right, that we have to engage with that issue. But I don't think he was suggesting that that means there's nothing more to discuss, that whatever people call justice is justice. Because we have a sense of fairness, a sense of injustice, which we want to surmount in the world. And it's a question of getting into public dialogue. And if this is, I mean, that's one of the things that even though I disagree with John Rawls in many ways, he does emphasize tremendously as to how important it is to have public reasoning, public dialogue about these. In his case, he tends primarily to think of these dialogues being confined within a particular society, a particular country. I would like much more global dialogue. And there I would be more with Martin Luther King when he argues that injustice anywhere in the world is a violation of justice everywhere in the world. And that's I think, a letter from Birmingham prison mm-hmm. that he wrote. I mean, that raises a kind of understanding implicit, open for public discussion and scrutiny and critique, but an immediate understanding of injustice, and then to discuss, am I right in thinking that? So I think it's very important to get into the engagement, and no one is probably more remembered as strongly as Socrates in being keen on having these discussions with others.
That brings us to another great theme of your book, that justice is not necessarily uniformly understood or perceived. And in the globalized period, this becomes more important. One culture's sense of what's justice may be different from another's. How does that square with Martin Luther King's observation?
Well, I think people's views on justice differ. I don't tend to take the view that they differ between cultures so much. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more similarity. The reason why Gandhi could communicate with Martin Luther King and Mandela is because there is something
over decades.
Yes, indeed. But on the other hand, Martin Luther King's views are not the same as some of the people who were arguing for the traditional, dominant role of the whites in southern United States. So I think quite a lot of the differences are within a country rather than between countries. And I think it's quite important. I mean, even if you take, this country, for example, allows capital punishment. Mm-hmm. Europe does not. This is the fourth country in terms of number of executions. I was looking up the number in 2008.
The United States globally. Mm-hmm.
Globally, yes. Mm-hmm. I think they're the highest. It's China by a long margin. Then comes Saudi Arabia, then Iran, and fourth is United States. And it disagrees there, differs very sharply with Europe in this, and agrees in some ways with China and with Saudi Arabia in that respect, in having more capital punishment here than you will be allowed to have in the United States, or for that matter in India. India allows capital punishment, mm-hmm. but I think since independence to today, less people have been executed than China executes every week. So I think there's a huge differences in this respect. But I wouldn't put it down to cultural differences. These are matters of debate, and I personally think even in a debate in the United States, the possibility of capital punishment could be more strongly questioned.
So maybe not culture, but certainly perspective. I mean, you raise this wonderful kind of little story or fable of you've got a wonderful flute, and
yeah.
you've got three children,
yeah.
and you're deciding there's only one flute, there are three children. Let me see if I can remember. One who can play the flute quite well, one who actually made the flute
yes.
with his or her own little hands,
yeah.
and one who's quite poor and impoverished and has nothing, to whom the flute would be an amazing gift. There's only one flute. To whom does the flute go? I take from this your point being that it depends on your perspective of what
that's
is
right.
justice.
But these no, you're absolutely right. And I think our perspectives could differ. I mean, just taking within the United States, I've been privileged, for example, in Harvard to teach with a number of people. Now, I think I can see that John Rawls would be very inclined to think about the poor person who, for whom, even though he may not be able to play the flute very well, the child, but on the other hand, he would have a toy, which the others already have, and he doesn't.
And perhaps that's justice to Rawls.
That's one that Robert Nozick, who was another close friend of mine, who I misliked John Rawls greatly. He died a few years ago. And he was a great libertarian. He would have certainly given it to the one who made the flute, on ground that he's entitled to it. And oddly enough, there the libertarians would agree with the Marxists, who take the view that if you have put your labor to make it, I mean, they may be both very uncomfortable in each other's company, but that's their position.
Same conclusion, perhaps.
And the third, the idea that that's a kind of utilitarian perspective, who would get the most out of playing it if somebody knows how to play the flute and others just blow air through it. That makes a difference. A lot of utilitarians would take that view. So within each society, there's these different perspectives. I think many of these debates could be reduced and there could be greater agreement, but I don't take the view that that open discussion would eliminate all the differences. What would happen is that there may be a very strong agreement that if there is a guy who actually is extremely poor and who has made the flute and is being snatched away from that person, that he or she may have some claim to it. And a lot of cases are like that, when people took on issues of subjugation of women or the of the slavery when America fought the Civil War, and you know, going back to Abraham Lincoln's time. And that's the kind of situation in which there could be agreement, even though the ideal view of the world of Lincoln and some people who were more radical than Lincoln at that time, as well as the other thinkers in the South, might not have agreed. But ultimately what happened is that the whole country came round to the view that slavery is unjust. So I think there is a possibility of proceeding. I mean, I want to emphasize both these points, that we do have disagreement. Many of these disagreements can be reduced and, in fact, eliminated by critical scrutiny. There's no substitute to critical scrutiny. And yet, it would be hopeless to assume that all these could be completely ironed out on the basis of critical scrutiny.
Globalization is a big subject in the book. This makes me want to ask you whether, on balance, you see globalization, which it's cultural but it's very heavily economic, as having increased the stock of justice on the planet. I mean, there are a lot of even children perhaps making little flutes in China for, you know, kids who are in New York or London or Paris or you name it.
Yeah, I think globalization is a very exciting issue because, you see, on one side, it had expanded the opportunities of many people. And those who are against it often, I think, wrongly think that the globalization is at fault rather than the way the global trade is conducted, because a lot of people haven't had this opportunity. Even in China, there are enormous opportunities of people who happen to be in the right region. But on the other hand, the whole areas of hinterland where there's huge amounts of poverty left behind. It would be wrong to blame globalization for it, but it would not be wrong to say that the fruits of globalization are not being justly shared. But the really interesting thing, Tom, here is that the protest about globalization is also a global phenomenon. The anti-globalization movement is perhaps the most globalized intellectual movement in the world today. People coming from everywhere, from New Zealand to Alaska to Malaysia to South Africa.
Well, but even in the hotbeds of it, in Bangalore, where many people are employed, answering phone calls from Americans, or I don't know, outside of Shanghai, when the factory baking.
Yeah, but people do discuss those issues. If you look at, I would say, not long ago in Bangalore, if you open the Bangalore paper, you will find people are talking about injustice, those who haven't had the opportunities that some of the Bangaloreans have had. And I think the global engagement on public reasoning is very important. I regard global engagement very big. I was very opposed to the Iraq War. But it isn't because I didn't think that it was a good idea to think about democracy in the world. I think it is a very good idea. I think landing your army in another country on the basis of rather bad information is not a very good way of proceeding. On the other hand, public discussion on issues like democracy is really very important.
Let me take a call on that front from Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda. Brenda, you're on the air with Amartya Sen.
Hi, Todd. It seems particularly fitting that we would focus on justice today, the anniversary of the attacks on us, because of the profound injustices that we have visited upon the peoples of Iraq and Afghanistan in the name of those attacks. And the connection to economics, of course, is obvious because the vast fortune that we have poured into the ongoing killing and destruction, the money and other resources, could have been used to further the cause of justice in our own country and around the world, could have been used in many ways. And you asked about how we think of justice, or do we think of justice in our daily lives. I belong to an international group called Women in Black, and we stand up against war and other forms of violence all around the world.
How do you think about justice for the victims in, let's say, Manhattan of 9/11, then, Brenda?
They certainly were victims, but two wrongs don't make a right. And for us to turn around and create innocent victims in other parts of the world does not do anything to bring back the victims on our own soil. So we could have honored them much better than the way we have done.
Brenda, let us delve into it, and thank you for your call. Amartya Sen, you expressed your skepticism about the war in Iraq, but cast your philosopher's eyes on all this American reaction to the, I think you'd have to say, injustice of the 9/11 attacks.
Well, it was a tremendous injustice indeed. I don't think Brenda is in any way denying that there was a tremendous amount of atrocity and injustice visited on people, completely unjustifiedly it on them in the way the 9/11 attacks were carried out. I think there are three things to say there. One, Brenda has already said that it doesn't help to eliminate that injustice to then carry on some actions, possibly through lack of information, certainly through a lack of intelligent planning. And I think the Iraq intervention was an unintelligent, uninformed.
Lean more toward Afghanistan. It may make the
Well, the Afghanistan, I think there is much more of a case. Now, it's a much harder case now because of the fact that partly because America lost steam in dealing with the Afghan thing because they opened the second front in Iraq, and that actually distracted resources and attention, a point that Obama tried to make a number of times during the campaign. But I think Brenda's point that you have to do things which actually address the issue rather than just go on taking a kind of we are right to take revenge on other people. That would be a wrong thing. So she is absolutely right on that. But secondly, and I don't think Brenda would deny that, I hope she wouldn't, that we also have to think how come a thing of this kind happened? Why did the 9/11 take place? And that requires not so much going into the mind of the people who carried out this who did these terrible things. But, you know, there are all these crazy people around. But the important thing to recognize that these movements have a lot of public support. And where the importance of public reasoning comes in is not trying to convert the murderers into a different mode of thinking, but the general sense of acceptance that you had. I mean, you know, the 9/11, even in many countries in the Middle East, for example, were greeted positively, even though people were sympathetic. But there was still a sense that there was some injustice to which this is a response. And I think one has to have an open public discussion that there may have been great injustices in the past, but this is not a way of addressing it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning thinker Amartya Sen about justice, social justice, and how we might make more of it. His new book is The Idea of Justice. He joins me in the studio. The Economist calls him an economist who thinks like a philosopher, who can theorize without oxygen at any height. So bring on your big questions here. Michael, in Watertown, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Amartya Sen.
Well, to answer your last question, I think that in America, in the States at least, justice is inhibited by a sort of what you might call Spencerian Calvinism that tends to see those who are on top as deserving to be there and those who aren't are just a bunch of damned losers, and it's even wrong to do anything for them. In any event, my initial question was, in a world where it's increasingly easy to create a lot of destruction with either technology or social hacking the way the 9/11 hijackers did it, can we even afford not to have some measure of justice all around the world?
The assumption that without it, somebody's going to press a button one day.
Well, someone will press a button inevitably. There will be another attack from somewhere. But if we want to reduce the pool of people who are more likely to do that, a sort of harm reduction, then it might be a good idea to increase justice and, for that matter, decrease superstition.
Does the imperative grow, Amartya Sen? Are we growing with it?
Well, I think so. I think there are two things to say, one of which Michael is concentrating on, which is that injustice is also creates a world in which atrocities can more easily happen. And we live in a world, and that's a point that he's also making because of technical change, where destruction is very easy to carry out, and therefore that is particularly important to address injustice. I think that's a very important point to make. To that I would add, however, the main argument for addressing an injustice isn't that it would make the world peaceful, but because injustice is a bad thing to happen. And it is also the case that the presence of injustice, especially gross injustice, makes the world less peaceful and more violent. That's certainly true. And that's a further reason for addressing injustice. But the basic reason for addressing injustice is, of course, that injustice is itself a terrible thing to happen, and we should protest against it, and we should try to do what we can. So I think I'm going to look at it, for example, the healthcare debates, for example, that on one side we might say that by not having healthcare, we have all kinds of effects. A lot of people get very desperate because they don't get the healthcare. They get bankrupt. Their relations die because they don't get treatment. Not to mention other things, that they can pass on their illnesses to others. In all kinds of ways, the injustice that is visited on the uninsured visits back on the insured and the rest of the community. That's enough to worry about on one side. But then again, the main reason for worry is that the uninsured have a very nasty time in the world in which they are not certain of what to do if they fall ill. So I think we have to put both these things together, that injustice is in itself something which we have reason to fight. But secondly, injustice is also something which tends to generate lack of peace and violence. And indeed, that is a further reason for fighting injustice.
I'm trying to understand the prescriptive aspect of this big and deep work, the idea of justice, your new book. And then it's bringing it back to healthcare and John Rawls. I mean, he would look for the institution, the ideal institution to address this particular problem, I guess. And I, in reading you say, well, don't get so hung up on the ideal institution. Go out and address the injustice directly. And somehow then I picture, is Amartya Sen saying, well, no, don't break too big a sweat trying to fix the institutions. Rather, just go out and help someone who's ill, who's sick, take a wet washcloth to their forehead.
I don't think I was quite saying that, Tom. Thank you for proposing that. But I have to slightly disagree.
Please do.
I think Rawls is quite right to say that if the institutions are bad, you have to fix them. And I'm 100% in agreement. But you go and begin by asking, what is the perfect institution? Just think that this country has been so dominated by discussion about the Canadian healthcare system. Mm-hmm. The Canadian healthcare system achieves many things that the U.S. healthcare system doesn't. On the other hand, it's also the case that you cannot have private insurance in Canada that will cover some of the procedures, like surgery. Mm. And you can get it for prescription medicine, for dentistry or for optometry and for a room, special room, but you cannot for many of the things. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, raises a kind of different type of issue as to whether if you're a very rich person, you're free to spend your money in buying a yacht, but you cannot buy health insurance. Is that fair? Now, I think we could have a debate, and we don't know whether the ideal system may be a Canadian-type system or a European-type system in which you have national health care, single payer for all, and at the same time, there are private insurances, which anyone can buy with their own money and be insured. Now, we could go on debating, but I think it would be a great mistake at this time to spend your time debating between France and United Kingdom on one side and Canada on the other. The important thing is what changes could bring about a world in the United States in which these 47 million uninsured people are no longer uninsured. They have an access to medical care. So my point here is that institution is right. Institutional concentration in this case is particularly important. And yet, it's not the question about what are the perfectly ideal institutions in the world, on which may continue to differ. Some people might say, look, I regard liberty as very important. I do want everyone to be covered by healthcare. On the other hand, I don't want to eliminate the possibility, as Canada does, to have private health insurance to cover everything, every kind of activity, including surgery and so on. And if others might say, no, that's not a very fair way of doing it. But I think it would be a waste of time to debate on that when the debate at the moment is not about that at all. That couldn't be a realistic debate. The realistic debate is how to expand the care. I understand that the issue about the public option is an important part of the debate, mm-hmm. and we are quite right to concentrate on that. And we are quite right to see how we can make sure that everyone is covered, rather than on the basis of history, some people be eliminated. So these are the things. So I think I'm being I'm supporting the kind of dialogue that Obama is trying to create at this time. And I'm also arguing that that's not the same thing as looking for an ideal institution.
Do you see in the United States or globally some kind of problem with a fixation on the ideal getting in the way of the actual practical achievement of greater justice?
Well, it's a complex question. Ideals are very moving for us. You know, you could find the French Revolution on liberty, equality, and fraternity, but it's very difficult to find the French Revolution saying a little bit more liberty, a little bit more equality,
yes,
and
yes,
perhaps a bit right. more fraternity. Because I think we need the ideals to move us, and we are creatures who respond to ideals, and they're very important. That's the point that Gandhi makes very forcefully. And yet, when it comes to practical debates, translating that, I mean, that's what went wrong with the French Revolution. If they were quite clear on the five perfect institutions, but ended up producing a reign of terror with such bloodshed that many of the great revolutionary thinkers themselves got, including Condorcet, who I mentioned. Mm-hmm. He killed himself when it was quite clear that the others will kill him if he didn't. And so it's a kind of situation in which I think the ideals have a huge moving power. But it would be wrong when it comes to actual scrutiny of policies to concentrate on that.
So our ideals may actually get in the way of achieving day-to-day justice.
At that level. And the ideals have their role to move us. You know, we believe in the truth. We believe in perfect justice. And I would fight to keep that vision. And yet, when it comes to saying, what are we going to do? And, you know, this as a book in philosophy, my book is concerned with what is the subject matter of theory of justice. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that on the basis of perfect justice, you cannot get any kind of an immediate criteria as to whether this change, which doesn't give us perfect justice, whether it reduces injustice or increases injustice. We ought to be able to make that comparison without losing the great vision, the great inspiring role that perfect vision of a perfect justice plays. So I think at the level of thinking philosophically or economic policy or social policy, in the case of healthcare, health policy, as we discussed earlier, global policy about Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on, I think it's not helpful to concentrate the policy debate on the ideal institutional framework without losing the fact that, after all, the institutions would continue to make people be involved with it, the people who are ready to go and fight and try to eliminate Al-Qaeda and give their life in Afghanistan, going all the way from the United Kingdom or the United States or somewhere else, are being moved by a huge vision. And that is extremely important to recognize and celebrate. And yet, when it comes to policy discussion, I think it's a mistake to concentrate would be exactly on that. I mean, they have all their respective roles.
Mm. Let's go to Anne in Northfield, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to respond to the question about how we even begin to work towards it in our lives and make it more conscious, seeking justice more conscious in how we act and decide. I think, on the highest level, probably there's pretty broad agreement as a goal, but a lot of sense of individual helplessness and powerlessness, that this is such an overwhelming issue that we almost don't want to focus on it or think of it. So when I think about where we begin and my own guide, I have always held on to the words of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and this may not be quite precise as a quote, but very close. He said, what is the most precious thing in the world? Not to participate in injustices. They are greater than you. They have occurred in the past, and they will occur in the future. But let them not come about through you.
Easier said than done. But what a great setting.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, it's a sort of individual consciousness of a beginning point, where we can make a personal impact if we think that way, and then that can begin to create a broader social consensus and change.
And thank you for your call. But how daunting, Amartya Sen, these days, with such an interwoven world, to try and live in such a way that you don't, that one doesn't participate in injustice.
Yeah.
We touch so many different streams of justice and injustice so casually in our life.
I think Anne is raising a very important issue there. The complexity of the issue, however, is this, that it's sometimes, even though it's hard to keep oneself away from participating in an injustice, hard as it is still simpler than a situation in which there is injustice going on, which you did not create. And you have to do something about it.
Even if you're not participating in it.
You're not participating. I mean, I'm not religious, but I do discuss in my book the point that Jesus tries to make in Luke in about the Samaritan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is this, there is the wounded man lying
by the road in need.
Yeah, and the Levite and the priest doesn't help.
Mm-hmm. They walk on by.
They hadn't caused the wound, and therefore they don't owe anything, and they are not participating in it by just walking away. On the other hand, the Samaritan thinks that he ought to do it, even though he's not a neighbor. That's the point that Jesus is making.
Mm-hmm.
Samaritans come from very far away,
mm-hmm.
not liked by the Israelites, and indeed not a neighbor of the Israelites. But he still thinks that there is a human being here, and I ought to help. Now, that is not by the call of keeping it. That's not the Solzhenitsyn story. The Jesus story is a longer story than that here, namely our neighborhood. And that's very important, very contemporary, really, because basically at the end of it, Jesus asked the question to the lawyer, namely when this wounded person gets up, and who would he think was his neighbor? And of course, the lawyer has to admit, who was arguing that your duties are only to your neighbor, that he must think that the Samaritan was his neighbor. And Jesus' point, therefore, at that point, is that we live in a world where our neighborhoods are somewhat defined by ourselves. If you help somebody, you are involved in a relationship, and you found a reason for doing it, and you've established a different relationship through that. So that I think Solzhenitsyn's principles may be right, but we have to go beyond that. And we have to consider about the injustices that's happening in the world in which we may not be participating. But if you are in a position to resist it, the question is, should we not do something to resist it? And I think the Samaritan answer there was, yes, indeed, we should. And I think that answer is basically right in this case. And I draw, of course, I go into the question about neighborhood in the book, because the global neighborhood today had made it Jesus's point much more central to our thinking today, because of the fact that, you know, we may be far away from each other, but nevertheless we are connected. I think David Hume made that point in the 18th century, that there was a time when we didn't know about people far away. But because of trade, and I think it relates, Tom, to your question about globalization, trade, economic and social relation, literary relations and so on, we know about them. And once that happened, our boundaries of justice ever grow wider.
But has it heightened our sensitivity to injustice or numbed that sensitivity?
I think it has heightened it. I think this is no question that it has. Because, you know, we do, I mean, we would like to grumble, and I do grumble, that it's not more than it is. We ought to be more globally conscious. And, you know, some of your callers, I think Brenda was talking about women in black and so on. And these are ways of communicating. And there are communications across the world. And I think even if you think about the Iraq thing, it was a mistake. But throughout the world, this was discussed as a mistake. One of the reasons why it was possible to change the situation, and that was one of the things that came up in the campaigns in the summer of 2008, last year, is to that how the American action in Iraq have alienated a lot of people across the world. People in the United States were aware of that issue too. And I think this is a big thing. And, you know, it's not only a partisan issue. I mean, even on the Bush side, I was always very impressed, for example, that Laura Bush was emphasizing very much the turmoil of the people in Burma, and that's something where we have to worry about, where a dictatorship and a brutal military dictatorship causing so much harm. So I think there are many signs from different sides of our being concerned with each other.
Nobel Prize winner laureate Amartya Sen's new book is The Idea of Justice. It's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.